Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we're celebrating 10 years of The Reading Life with some of our wonderful guests. Thanks for joining us. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. Today marks a very special episode, our 10th anniversary, and we'll be looking back at some of our visits with great Louisiana writers. From the very beginning, we've tried to get at what makes Louisiana special for writers, its endless sources of inspiration, as well as the importance of good stories and how important reading is in all our lives. So let's hear what these Louisiana writers had to say. For Anne Rice, the sensual detail that characterizes her writing about New Orleans came from a childhood of being surrounded by beauty.
You know, I grew up on the corner of St. Charles Avenue and Phillips Street, and I walked through the Garden District every day of my life as a child. And you know what that's like. You see the beautiful old Greek Revival antebellum homes all around you. And you, in New Orleans, you are always in contact with beauty, sensuous beauty. It's not just the incredible architecture of the Garden District or uptown or the quarter, but you're in contact with beautiful oak trees and lavish gardens and lovely old picket fences and cast iron railings that are delicate and beautiful have been called iron laced railings. And ever since I was a tiny child, I was sensitive to all of that, very sensitive to it. And I never understood why everybody else wasn't sensitive. You know, why other kids weren't just falling down on the pavement saying, look at that gorgeous house. Look at the color of those, you know, that wall at sunset. Look at these gardens. Because I always was. It was always intoxicating to me. And I have poured all that into my writing. I really have. I can't help it.
Big Frida, the Queen Diva. For Big Frida, it was time to tell her story in the hopes of helping other people in Big Frida, God Save the Queen Diva. Well, say you're a young gay man reading this book. What do you want those readers to take away from your story?
I want them to be inspired to just be themselves, be free. Everyone has a story, and your story is your life. And I just want people to, you know, at the end of the day, this is just all me, being myself, growing, experiencing things in life, life-changing situations, situations that God has saved me in and pulled me through. So people will be inspired, and it will be inspiration for people to know that no matter what you go through, no matter who you are, no matter how, you know, race, color, any of that, you can just keep pushing through and just be yourself. And my story, you know, like I said, come from where I come from, growing up on Josephine, little black gay boy, and now being international and all over the world, that's a blessing. Yeah. And I'm just, like I said, so thankful and so grateful to be able to have a story to be able to share with the readers and somebody that can actually get something out of my story.
Richard Campanella of Tulane University found lessons in telling the story of our most famous thoroughfare in Bourbon Street, a history. If anyone could tell the story of a single street in such detail, it could only be you, really.
Well, the phenomena that this particular street offers for interpretation spans the entire spectrum and the full 300 years. And this is really the first full-length, in-depth history of Bourbon Street of the full three centuries, from as a kind of a cultural artifact, but also its physical, its built environment, its physical mm-hmm. geography.
Now, one of the things that's so interesting to me is that there are certain stereotypical ways we think about Bourbon Street. It has certain associations. And you talk about how you fell prey to those associations, that it wasn't something serious to study. And then Katrina changed all that for you.
I came to realize what a mistake that was, to dismiss it as this silly, empty metaphor. I've always been curious as to where did this come from? Where did this phenomena come from, and why there? You know, the fundamental geographical question of explaining location. Why not some other street? Why not Dauphine or Royal? And I went through the same cycle that many people do of being curious about it, but then being dismissive of it. And one moment that really changed my opinion was the realization right immediately after Katrina, even during Katrina, that this was the one place that demonstrated that the human heart was still beating in this city. I'm speaking of the days right after the storm, at the absolute nadir of this city's history, when a couple of bars remained open, a couple of clubs soon reopened, a few musicians and buskers played in the streets, and it gave something for the cameras to focus on, other than this catastrophe and this death and dying, that began to change the subject. And to be sure, later that month, it was the first space to come back. It was the first one to bring back jobs. It was the first space to send tax dollars back to City Hall coffers.
If you're just joining us, we're looking back at 10 years of the Reading Life. In talking about City of a Million Dreams, A History of New Orleans in Year 300, Jason Berry recalled a shared moment with a beloved musician, his friend Danny Barker. Of course, going through this book, music is a great thread because you've written so much about musicians over your career. Louis Armstrong, of course, is here, and you conclude with a wonderful figure of Michael White, whom we all adore so much. But as you mentioned earlier, you have a wonderfully evocative chapter about the contributions of Danny Barker.
I have to say that Danny Barker was among the three or four most remarkable people I've ever known or had the luck to interview. We became friends. I got mm-hmm. to know him well. I interviewed him on a number of occasions. I will never forget, this was barely months before he died, he was sitting on my living room couch, and this story is in the book, and I said, you know, you have really done everything. You have traveled the world. You've done several books, recordings with everybody from Armstrong to Wynton. Of course, you play with Blue Lou all the time, your wife. The one thing I'm curious about, what is the secret of sustaining a marriage for 63 years? And he looked at me with those bedroom eyes and that thin mustache, and he kind of gave me a little arch of the brow, and he said, well, you go to Mass, you listen to the priest, and you go on about your business. And I said, so that's it. You just hunker down, say your vows, and 63 years later, you're still married. And he paused, perfect beat, and then he said, no, you have to give her the money.
That was really perfect.
I made the mistake of telling my wife, Melanie, that one time. And periodically, she will say to me, remember what Danny Barker said.
So. That was really wonderful. That's a great story.
There's a happy land far, far away, where they have some ham and eggs several times a day. Hear them boys yell when they hear that kitchen bell. They're gonna give the landlord hell several times a day.
Michael Tisserand found solace post-Katrina in a museum exhibit, as well as the inspiration for his book, Crazy, George Harriman, A Life in Black and White.
An exhibit came by. I was going across the country and stopped in Milwaukee, called The Masters of American Comics. And the second room was all George Harriman original comics.
the beautiful ink work, and you can see the faint pencil work underneath it. And a lot of them were actually Gary Trudeau's. He owned a lot of those originals and loaned them to the exhibit. So my son was with me. He's 6'4 now, but at the time I was carrying him around and reading the comics out loud to him. And it was, I think, a combination of seeing the art on the wall and reading for the first time Harriman's words out loud that made me realize I wanted to write more about him. I think also as I was feeling like a New Orleans exile at that point, and I identified a bit with what I tried to guess at he must have felt as a 10-year-old, you know, in Los Angeles, having left everything he knew behind in New Orleans.
Nothing has been more exciting than watching the trajectory of Maurice Carlos Ruffin's career. Here he is, reading from his 2019 novel, We Cast a Shadow.
A dark-skinned child can expect a life of diminished light. This is true anywhere in the world and throughout most of history. But let's stick to the home of the free. Place young Jamal on an all-white basketball team, and guess who will get ejected from the game more often for normal, rambunctious behavior. Give a hiring manager a stack of applications and let him choose between an equally qualified Jamal, Jane, or Jonathan. See Jamal waiting at the unemployment office again. Admittedly, none of these examples are particularly shocking, and I fear that I risk insulting your intelligence, dear reader. But ride with me a while longer. See Jamal evicted from his apartment. See Jamal arrested for vagrancy. See Jamal mysteriously die in a transport van on the way to the city jail. A brief interlude of cursing the heavens. Resurrect Jamal with lightning. Smoke, sparks, the smell of burning cocoa butter. Put a toy in Jamal's hand in an open carry state. Wait for Jane or Jonathan to call the police due to a suspicious-looking black guy. See the cavalry show up and scalp Jamal, no questions asked. Jane is heartbroken for the tragic misapprehension of the situation, she says over a pumpkin spice latte, as Jonathan bites the tip of a double chocolate biscotti. I have a natural aversion to numbers and statistics, as they can be manipulated by any reactionary with an agenda. But that doesn't change the objective fact that prospects for African Americans have devolved even since my grandparents' time. Black women make 30 cents for every dollar a white man does, and 90% of black moms are single mothers. Unemployment among black males is the norm, not the exception, and 9 out of 10 brothers have done time. And virtually none of us black guys and dolls can vote, since felons and the children of felons need a voucher from some upstanding citizen to earn a voting pass. JoJo was mine. None of that even takes into account the fact that every black person is a de facto enemy of our state. They used to call bringing every able-bodied black male to jail for questioning, racial profiling, and now it's called excellent police work. And did I mention that blacks in most major cities live in fenced-in ghettos, just like the Tico? There may be beauty in my blackness and dignity in the struggle of my people, but I won't allow my son to live a life of diminished possibility. I see a constellation of opportunity that those of my ilk rarely travel to. I see my Nigel at the center of those stars.
Sarah Broom garnered critical acclaim and a National Book Award for her book, The Yellow House, A Memoir, published in 2019. Now, so much of this book is about home. And I remember after Katrina, I noticed that people said home differently, the word. They said it a little more softly with a slightly longer O. You know, they lavished that word with affection, home. And you've written so much about the Yellow House as a source of shame, as a source of family kind of cohesiveness. And then after Katrina, to have it gone, just to have it demolished.
Sure.
I just can't even imagine. And then to fight the road home battle for how many years? 11?
Yeah, for 11 years. You know, this is so hard. This is the heart of it all, really, because the thing I always remind myself is that my mother bought this house when she was 18, 19 years old with every cent she had. It was her dream. It was a place she loved. It was a place she built up. It was a place she raised her 12 children in. The house was a repository for us. It was the witness to our lives. When I see any house missing from any landscape, whether it's in New Orleans, whether it's in Detroit, whether it's in Cambodia, something is shaken in me because very, very quickly, I think about the stories that that house contained. I think about the family who's been displaced from that house. And so for me, that was really the work to start to think about what happens to all of us when these places we know and these places we love are suddenly gone, even if they're still there and transfigured, but gone in some sort of way.
Albert Woodfox was a Pulitzer finalist and a National Book Award finalist for his memoir, Solitary, My Life in Solitary Confinement. One of the most moving passages in his story talks about the importance of books in his prison life.
My greatest achievement, after years in prison and solitary confinement, I had experienced all the emotions the Louisiana Department of Public Safety and Correction wanted from me. Anger, bitterness, the thirst to see someone suffer, the way I was suffering, the revenge factor, all that. But I also became something they didn't want or expect. Self-educated, I could lose myself in a book. Reading was a bright spot for me. Reading was my salvation. Libraries and universities and schools from all over Louisiana donated books to Angola. And for once, the willful ignorance of the prison administration paid off for us because there were a lot of radical books in the prison library, books we wouldn't even be allowed to get through the mail, books we never could have afforded to buy, books we had never heard of. Harmon King and I first gravitated to books and the authors that dealt with politics and race. George Jackson, Frantz Fanon, Malcolm X, Marcus Garvey, Steve Biko, Eldridge Cleaver, Soul on Ice, J.A. Rogers from Superman to Man. We read anything we could find on slavery, communism, socialism, Marxism, anti-imperialism, the African independent movements, and independent movements from around the world. I would check off these books on the library order form and never expect to get them until they came. Leaning against my wall in the cell, sitting on the floor, on my bed, or at my table, I read.
In a 2015 visit to his home in Oscar, Louisiana, we talked with MacArthur winner and National Book Critics Circle Award winner Ernest Gaines about the way his characters always left and came back, something he often called this Louisiana thing that drives me.
My characters cannot escape from Pinkerby.
Right.
I went to California when I was a child. I was 15 years old when I went to California. But I tell my people that my body went to California, but the soul remained here. You know, I went to school in the church back there from the primer to sixth grade. Then I went to a little Catholic school for colored children, as they said at that time, and New Roads for 3 years, and then I went to California. When I went to California, I went to the library for the very first time. I was not allowed to go to a library around here because they were all for whites, not for blacks. And I fell in love with books. And I think I substituted the library at that time to the church for the library. But although I have books, lots of books all over the place now, the church is still part of my character, my burden. I can't leave it. That's why I moved the church and the yard back here when I bought this land to build this house. Although I substituted it for the library, I still must have it with me at all times. So I have that, I am the writer I am today because I had to go. Mm-hmm. However, I had to come back to do the writing. I went to the library in California, studied. But I had to come back to my source, which was the church, and that's the connection between me and my community.
Gaines didn't marry until late in life, having made an early decision to commit to his art.
I said I would sacrifice everything in the world to be the writer because no one in the history of my family had gone above high school. Uh-huh. No male, and a couple of female, my mother's sister, and maybe a brother, her brother, had gone to beyond high school. I just knew that I had to do something. When I was a kid here, on this same place where we're living now, I used to write letters for the old people, just to write letters for them, because they could not write or read their letters because they had to read. And I was the only one they called on to do those things. I know a little boy running up down the road, they'd call on to do those things for them. And I felt very young that I had to be somebody. For my aunt who raised me, who was crippled all her life, crawled over the floor all of her life, crawled across the yard, crawled into the vegetable garden, I had to do something for her to make me proud of who I was. And I think that was the force that was driving me to be that writer. And fortunately, I'm the oldest of my siblings. I didn't have to go out and work to help support my mother or anyone else. Mm-hmm. I had that freedom to go out and just write if you wanted to write. And that's what I chose to do.
Sadly, we lost Ernest Gaines in 2019. If you're just joining us, we're looking back at 10 years of the reading life. One of the writers I most admire is MacArthur winner and two-time National Book Award winner Jesmyn Ward, whose beautiful stories of grief offer beauty and solace. Her most recent book, published in 2017, is Sing, Unburied Sing. I kind of think now in contemporary literature, grief is the great subject. Mm-hmm. Grief is the thing that everyone must reckon with. And you do that on so many layers of experience in this book. Mm-hmm. So many people are dying or haunting or possibly getting lost. Mm-hmm. It is a haunted story in so many ways.
It is. I think part of the reason that I write about death and the experience of grief is, of course, because because I lost my own brother, right? Mm-hmm. I think before that I was, maybe when I was younger, maybe when I was in my 20s, in my early 30s, that I thought a lot about death in relationship to people dying young or dying early, right? And I think now as I get older, that I'm also thinking about what it means to lose someone who is older, right? What it means to lose someone to illness, right? What it means to lose someone in their later years. And so I think that I'm sort of wrestling with all the different ways. Yeah. Some of my friends have lost older relatives, and something that I said to one of them when I was younger was that I said, oh, it always feels wrong. Death always feels wrong, whether or not you lose someone when they're very young or whether or not you lose your great-grandmother who's 90 years old. It always feels like something that should not happen, even though it's the thing that's always going to, it's the thing that's always going to happen. You know, as I was writing this book and especially writing about Ma'am, writing about her illness and her struggle with her illness, that's one of the ideas that was in the back of my head, right? This idea
grief is such a combination of, it's an emotional roller coaster ride. And so much of it is anger and so much of it is love. Mm-hmm. And, I look at your work and a lot of your work has been propelled by anger. Mm-hmm.
you know, Men We Reaped, mm-hmm. I think, was. And, mm-hmm. of course, the fire this time mm-hmm. after the death of Trayvon. Mm-hmm. That was something that was so important mm-hmm. and catalyzing for you. Mm-hmm. So what do you feel is the strongest driving force now in Sing Unburied Sing? Do you feel it's the love or you feel the anger? Or what was your emotional feeling? Well, I mean, what was going on in your head, Jess?
Oh, wow, that's a tough
one.
No,
but you know what I mean? It's like you're torn between these two feelings.
Yes.
And this is a book that is rich in love mm-hmm. and rich in anger, too.
That's a really hard question to answer. Like, I don't know if I can answer it well. I mean, I think that it's true. Like, one of the strongest emotions that you feel when you're wrestling with grief is that sense of anger and rage, because you're so helpless in the face of it, and because you realize that all you can do is live with this thing. You have no control in that situation, and that's the only proactive thing that you can do, is to figure out how to live with this mm-hmm. this loss and with this sort of sadness. And then I think you feel anger too, because you realize that you're going to carry this around for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Maybe that is at the heart of it.
Maybe it's finding the way to honor it.
Yeah.
You know, to honor the loss.
That's true.
Many, many thanks to all the writers who shared their work with us and to all the listeners who tuned in. Thanks are also due the following: Octavia Books and Tom Loewenberg and Judith Lafitte, who believed in this project from the start. Producers Jenny Lawson and George Ingmeyer, who have taught me so much. Paul Mawson and Ron Biava and all the good folks at WWNO. And the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Hellas Foundation. Thanks for 10 great years. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Coming up, there will be a socially distant book signing with Mark Morial for his book, The Gumbo Coalition, 10 Leadership Lessons That Help You Inspire, Unite, and Achieve. Friday, December 18th from 1:30 to 3:30 p.m. at Blue Cypress Books. Lucky Bean Poetry and Press, in collaboration with NOLA DNA, are publishing its first ever Mardi Gras zine and are accepting Mardi Gras poems. To be considered, send your poem in a Word or Google document to submissions@luckybeanpoetry.com. And check out the website, luckybeanpoetry.com, while you're there. Make sure to include your contact info, submissions considered until December 25th. Support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.